Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, First Take, Her Take. Check out the First Take, Her Take podcast hosted by Charlie Arnold, Kimberly A. Martin, and joining the show this week is their new co-host is L. Duncan from the 6 o'clock Sports Center, where they'll spill the tea on their lives while also discussing the hottest stories in sports and pop culture. Follow First Take, Her Take as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. Also, The Ultimate Fighter is back. The reality show that brings top MMA prospects together under one roof to compete for a UFC contract is on ESPN+. Featherweight champion Alexander Volkanovski and Brian Ortega coach men's bantamweights and middleweights who have put their lives on hold for the chance to pursue their UFC dreams. Stream new episodes every Tuesday, only on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com/UFC. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is that time of week where we have a guest join us. And I mean, it's kind of Howard Bryant week in the news with everything that has been going on of Meadowlark Media. Howard Bryant is here to join us. You are Boston. You kind of like, you know, outside a New Edition, you like the black dude from Boston that we know, like not just we being people on the call. Like, I feel like in some total, like this is it's a thing. People don't realize y'all out here.
There's two of us. Sorry, there's 5 of us. Right. Although, can I just like be a traitor to my town and say I was not a huge New Edition guy?
Ooh.
I was not huge. I liked them when they got a little bit older, but that Jackson 5 sound was just a little too candy for me.
Well, the other thing is, like, I go back and I enjoy that stuff, but let's be real. They wasn't making their records for you to buy them.
It's okay for me to say this is not for me, right? Y'all even selling this to me.
Yeah, you were not the demo. Like, that was not what it was that they were going for. Now, we got a lot of different things we're going to get to. We're going to get to Naomi Osaka. But you told us before you jumped out here to record this that you had been on the telephone for an hour, which left me fairly confident that you had not heard what is being reported. And I am going to a report now from Clevis Murray. I think it is pronounced Clevis. Works for The Athletic. Clevis Murray is reporting that Danny Ainge is not certain of his future with the Celtics and that he may wind up going to the Utah Jazz.
Where he belongs.
That's what I was about to say. He can go holler at Jabari Parker and be like, hey, dog, let's take it back to the crib. The crib, you know?
So many levels, right? I mean, one, Danny Ainge did embarrass himself and exposed himself. I mean, you and I have been talking about this for a while now. When you think about the three historically, and when I say historically, I'm talking about NBA probably leading up to about the late 90s, I would guess, and then the game began to shift as it became more international. But up to that point, the three whitest teams in the NBA had always been the Boston Celtics, Danny Ainge, the Phoenix Suns, Danny Ainge,
yeah,
and the Utah Jazz, potentially now Danny Ainge, although Danny Ainge is like, you know, there you go, right?
Yeah, he was saying BYU, he's Mormon.
And so this would like sort of complete the Danny Ainge circle of the white American in the NBA. It would, now the circle is complete. Also, we know this. Devastating losses have devastating consequences. And you can make an argument. You can make a very, very, very good argument that this Boston Celtics team needs new voices. That this group has sort of run their course from the beginning of the Isaiah Thomas grinder team to getting more talent. And now, you know, you've got the Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum team, you know, the Kyrie Irving experiment, the Brad Stevens thing. They're regressing. They're not as good as they were 3 years ago. And obviously, when I say devastating losses have devastating consequences, what game are we talking about? We're talking about Game 7 at home against Cleveland. You've got to win that game. Everything changes if they win that game. And they had a lead in the fourth quarter, whatever it was. They did not handle that. And they've not really been the same team since.
That was the 2018 year when Kyrie got hurt and didn't play in the
playoffs, and
right?
Kyrie wasn't even there.
But see, that year made everything weird, though, because
That's Kyrie, right.
Then came back the next year, and they were not as good as they were when Kyrie was there. And that year before he got hurt, Kyrie was playing excellent.
He was playing phenomenal. And this is the reason why I say to people all the time, I've been watching Boston Celtics basketball for a very, very long time. And that first half of the year when Kyrie was there was some of the most enjoyable, remarkable basketball I've ever seen. The only thing recently that even came close was being able to see Kevin Garnett up close for the first time day in and day out, where it was like, wow, right? And so for it to fall apart the way it fell out, okay, everyone's going to pay for this. There's only two choices here. You're either going to come back and ball out and fix this, or everything's going to fall apart. And everything fell apart. And the other piece of this, which I think is even more important in the news right now, is this whole race and Boston thing, which Boston can never seem to get rid of. But where I'm going with this is from a business standpoint, the idea, which may very well be Danny Ainge's greatest failing, was the idea that Boston could somehow be in play in this super team. We will lure you to come here. And I'm talking about the whole Anthony Davis pursuit. I think that really did sort of shatter a lot of things in terms of making people feel comfortable, right? Did you really believe that that was possible for the city of Boston to happen? And I never did. I was like, does Danny Ainge really think he's going to compete with Los Angeles and all these other places where you're going to create a super team? I never thought that was possible. And I thought it really undermined the young players that they had there in the chemistry that they were trying to create there, because Danny was kind of telegraphing, we'll get rid of all of you for Anthony Davis. And I'm like, Anthony Davis is not going to commit to Boston. In the history of the game, in the free agent game, there have only been two black players who have been able to go wherever they wanted to go and chose willfully the city of Boston. It's Al Horford and Kemba Walker. That's it. I mean, Garnett and those guys re-upped, but they were already there. They got traded. I'm talking free agent, A-list, chose Boston. It's a big deal.
See, my thing with the Anthony Davis move was, and I still contended, he said he don't want to come here. Cool. You're coming anyway, right? I would have made the play. Like, if you think Anthony Davis is that good, because I've always said they had a team full of low spades, right? But they still didn't have that guy. And so my thing is, Oklahoma City made a move for Paul George, who wanted to go to LA, and he liked the team that he was on, and they could offer him the most money. And so he stayed. Like, if you got to have some measure of faith in your organization, the way Milwaukee got Giannis to stay there, right? Like, the only way Boston's going to get those guys is to trade for them. And my thought was, you got to bring him in and then figure out how to make it work. But what you couldn't do, you couldn't have the world thinking you were working on it and that the whole roster is at play with all those young dudes who still think they special. And then they all got to come back. That was what you could not do. That's the people stuff, right? Like, that's what he then came back around and did. And so to me, though, if I was a Celtics fan, I'd be furious, I tell you, furious if this dude put this team together and nobody really sees a clear path for them to get better. And you got Kemba Walker's bad knees under contract for another couple of years and you're going to leave?
That's right.
The Ainge era for me, man, he got Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen. And they did the whole, I'll go if you go. You go first. Same time, right? And then they decided they could go there, and they made a nice run out of it. And then after that, I give Ainge credit that he kept him above water, but he had all those picks and all that, and he tried to play for the future and the present at the same time, and you cannot do that, right? And in the end, what you got was Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. Not bad guys to have. I don't think you're winning a championship with either of them as your best player.
Interesting. And I think that on top of that, when you look at what they were trying to do, I think you're 100% right. I just don't think you can sell this franchise the way you can sell Los Angeles. And that's not even a remarkable thing to say. It's just, and everybody gets their back up. Oh, what are you talking Boston for? Because every city has its challenges, right? Every place has, you've got your obstacles that you have to deal with by being where you are, right? And so that's just how it works. And I think that the disruption during that year was enormous to them. I mean, those guys were fragile and they needed to be told that they were going to be Celtics. And, you know, and you're right. Kevin Garnett is a good example. Kevin Garnett came to Boston and then he became a Celtic. He's out there caping for the logo now, right? I mean, so that's the advantage of saying, okay, he may not want to stay long-term, but we're going to get him in here and maybe the culture will shift it and change it, right? And change right. his mind and he'll stay here.
Yeah, give him something he wants to be a part of. Like I say, Sam Presti pulls that off. You know what I mean? Sam Presti got that. And now, granted, they then went and tore the whole thing down, right? But people have to remember, Paul George didn't ask out of there until Paul George found out they were trying to trade him. And he was like, oh, in that case, I've got an idea that I might be able to propose to you guys. I've been talking to my buddy Kawhi. You could send me down there. You know, that could be the move you make. Now, you talk about, you know, just like the challenges. It's interesting because, look, man, I said this all the time. NBA, if free agency is going to matter in the way it does and players are going to have the power to kind of get to destinations they want in the way they do, bottom line is this league got a bunch of bad real estate, right? It's got a lot of places where all things held equal, dudes don't want to stay there, right? So think about this. And this is what they did when they put the cap on contracts, the max contract cap, that they did not realize they were going to be doing. Sacramento got Chris Webber to stay, right? In this day and age, I don't think that happens. Mm-hmm. But they could money whip him. Whipped him, and they were like, it's a 45-minute flight to L.A. You can go down there every off day if you want to. And Chris Webber stayed in Sacramento. If you put Chris Webber back in Sacramento, there's no way they're going to get him to stay if it's about where you want to be. If it's about the real estate, they're not going to be able to pull this off. The difference with Boston, though, and this is, I don't know if it's just with the franchise, but definitely with the fans, Utah, for example, they know don't nobody want to go play for them. I can't remember if he was the TV guy or the radio guy, but he did an interview right after Gordon Hayward went to Boston, speaking of people, you know, who were trying to, like, do all the pilgrimages, right? He was just like, why was it such a big deal for Utah that they lost Gordon Hayward? And it was like, if we can't keep a white American player, who can we keep? He flat out said it, which, by the way, not mad at them, right? Now, implicitly, they might want to ask themselves some questions about why it is that your place is not attractive to these people. But he flat out said it. But the people in Utah are not in denial about this fact.
Well, they're not going wild about it the way Boston does.
Yeah, for whatever
reason. And that's the difference.
Yeah, what is it about Boston that makes it where people, right or wrong, this is what everybody telling y'all. You can fight it or you might want to deal with the reality that, hey, man, black folks don't rock with what y'all are doing up here.
In some levels, it's not even really your fault. This is what happens when, like, here's the thing about Boston that people just don't want to talk about. Boston has all kinds of challenges. Boston, obviously, you've got to deal with the history and you've got to deal with all of that. You've got to deal with the perceptions and all that other stuff. But here's what you really have to deal with. If you're a 22-year-old black kid living in Boston, is there enough party, enough culture, enough women, enough all of the social stuff that a 22-year-old wants to do compared to Miami, compared to Los Angeles? I mean, I moved, right? Right? People move, right?
Hold up, though. We're not even really talking about 22, though. Like, 22 yeah. is kind of what it is. We're talking about, like, 27, 28, who've been around now and seen some places and are like, nah, I don't think this is the thing that I want to do. Like, it's wild because the Celtics have all this tradition, you know, and when they're good, the fans are all into it and everything. You got an arena that even the New Garden has an atmosphere to it and all of this stuff. But nobody talks about going and playing in Boston like they do playing Madison Square Garden against the sorry Knicks, right? Now, granted, the Knicks have not gotten really anybody to come sign, but nobody talks about the prospect of Boston like the mecca of basketball being Madison Square Garden is hilarious when you think about it in an NBA context. But you see the look on Zion Williamson's face when he talks about playing in New York.
Well, because that's when the lights come on, right? That's what they talk about.
Right, but Boston ain't that. You know what I mean? Like, nobody talks about it in that way. It is not, to be fair, Philadelphia ain't a great sell. Ain't had a great sell to get people to come in from the outside either. But when you start talking about the particulars in Boston, and of course it came up with the Kyrie situation this week, it is a different level of defensiveness about it.
Well, they're tired of it. But it is not a great policy to say, my position is, what about your house? what about your neighborhood? What about where you come from? What about, yeah, that's not it either. But I just think that from a business standpoint, you know that here are the things that we can offer you and here are the things that we cannot offer you. which is one of the reasons why I honestly believe that the NBA needs to find some way to get rid of its salary cap, because in some way you should have to overpay certain guys to get them to stay or to go to places, right? I mean, real estate is an amazing way to put it, because when you go early 90s, Phoenix was a great destination. Do you know how hard it is to go 11 years and not make the playoffs in a league where half the teams make the playoffs? You don't even have to have a winning record necessarily to make the playoffs in the NBA, although in the Western Conference you kind of do. But the Phoenix Suns, how many true free agent destinations do you have in the NBA? Chicago's not even been a great free agent destination post-Jordan, mm-mm, right? Miami, Los Angeles, Dallas, Houston.
I would say Houston, not Dallas. I mean, Mark Cuban's been betting on this for years and it hasn't happened, right?
I mean, Golden State hasn't been a – obviously Durant was the big scorer, so you can say, yes, absolutely, it was a success. But you got 30 teams and you have a half dozen places that people will voluntarily go to. That puts you in a really difficult bind. Difference with Boston is we wouldn't be having this conversation if they didn't have, you know, 17 championships. That's the incongruity here, right? Which is, wait a minute, you got 17 championships and nobody wants to come here. How do you build that for the future? It's like Green Bay. It's one of these weird championship places that is not a magnet.
Right. There also is in the NBA places, if you're operating on the idea, where is it good to be a young black man with a pocket full of money, right?
That's right.
Places that fit that description that are not free agent destinations, there never have been.
Like D.C.
Atlanta, D.C. Those are the two that really jump off the page where you're like, damn, still don't nobody even want to go there. Then there's this interesting one, which is Orlando, which is not a free agent destination now. But for people who are not old enough to remember this, I forget what year it was exactly. However, they got, I think it was 2001. They got Grant Hill and Tracy McGrady to sign there in the same year. And they signed Tracy McGrady because they thought they had Tim Duncan. And Tim Duncan at the end changed his mind and decided to go back. Like, Orlando was attractive enough at that point that they could get what proved to be at the time three of the 10 best players in the NBA. All wanted to go there in one offseason. None
was
of us
Grant
would
Hill
ever
top 10 back in 01?
The ankle crapped out right before he went to Orlando.
Yeah.
They were able to get those people. Now, granted, this is even after the max salary, I believe, has come around. But they were, mm-hmm, they would have been able to pull this off. And so if you're going to get guys to come, you're going to have to do it with a first-class organization. And so what would look at all these other teams as, like, if you want to get guys to come here, you got to do what Mark Cuban did when he got to Dallas, because a lot, again, for those of you not old enough to remember, they were a flat-out laughing stock when he bought that team. They were by far the worst team in the NBA, worse than the expansion teams. Like, they were the worst team in the NBA. And then Cuban did the stuff, like, make the locker room plush, right? The most comfortable seats on the bench for the players and all of that stuff. That's what you had to do. And so all these teams, it's like Danny Ainge, instead of fighting it, nah, man, y'all need to be out here and like having an MLK Day thing bigger and better than anywhere else in the league, right? Or whatever it takes to make people feel like, no, Boston is a place that you want to be. The baseball team figured it out, but they figured it out because they were like, yo, those Dominicans are black, but not like we talking about. They got their own part of town over here where they can go speak Spanish and get the groceries that they like, and they'll come. And they did.
Well, and that was the other thing I was going to say. It was like, you know, people that don't understand Boston, what they don't understand most about Boston is that Boston is not a African-American city only. It's an island city. My people were from Barbados. You got Haitians there. You got Dominicans. You know, you got Hunter. I mean, you got all kinds of black people in Boston. So if you've got a small black population in the first place, now you got a black international population. Like when we were growing up in Dorchester before we moved, right? I mean, I think we were the only black family, black American family on the block.
We have to stop. As we sit here, Brad Stevens is moving into the front office on a full-time role, and the Celtics are expected to start a search for a new head coach. Sources tell ESPN.
This is the Boston show.
All happened.
And the hits keep on coming. And all I was going to say was that the brother living next door to us in Boston was Haitian. He was kicking a soccer ball. He didn't have no basketball, right? I mean, if you want to understand Boston, you got to understand that it is not your traditional black, you know, city in the black population, because you're dealing, you know, you're dealing with a lot of island folks up there. So the culture of the city has to be sort of dissected, and people just get their backs up way too much. You can't even have a single conversation with people immediately jumping down your throat going, what about New York? What about Howard Beach? What about Bensonhurst? What about it? We're talking about Boston right now. Let's deal with what you have to deal with, especially if you're trying to attract people to come to play for your team.
What I don't think Boston folks get is, for whatever reason, man, black people go all around this country, right? Two things to keep in mind. Number one, people jumped on the railroads and went everywhere, baby. They went to Chicago. They went to Milwaukee. They got in their cars and they went to California. They went to New York. They went to D.C. They went to Philadelphia. They went all them places. They wasn't buying them tickets to go up to Boston, baby. For whatever reason, the word got down, like, nah, I don't know. Maybe y'all ain't had no factories, right? Maybe the job situation wasn't cracking. I don't know. But the word got out. The Great Migration stories are not there for Boston. When it was a huge metropolis, right? For whatever reason, didn't quite make it there. That's number one to consider. Number two, we as black people go all over the place, and people just wind up with visceral reactions about Boston that they do not have about any other place, right? It's not that it's the only racist place in the world, right? But for whatever reason,
it lands differently in that city.
I had a buddy who made a point once, and I think this is worthwhile. And his thing was, you got to understand that people in Boston are ass, right? And so his thing was, they're jerks. So when you add the natural jerk to the racism, it gets exacerbated, but they're also mean to each other all of the time. So it's like all of it winds up getting heightened, where are they more racist than other people?
I had to get rid of that, Bo. When I first moved to California, I realized what an asshole I was. You know, I'm actually serious about this. Do you know why? Because it's that East Coast sarcasm that we have. Like, if you ask somebody a question, right, the East Coast in you may very well have to give you some sort of snappy answer instead of just saying yes or no. Mm-hmm. What time is it? What time does it look like? Just give me the, just tell me what time it is, right? What's it look like? What do you think? Why are we doing this right now? Right? I mean, and so there's this certain delivery that we have on the East Coast, Boston, New York, Philly. And that's why they talk about us as, you know, as fans, Boston, New York, Philly, most hostile places. And it's true. It's a different place. I always said that, it, you know, the problem with Boston as a place is Boston, it's got the small enough black population and people are fighters.
Yes.
People be fighting in Boston for their space. And there's not a lot of space. And it's dominated by a group of people historically, the Irish, who came to that city, who said, you guys stomped on us, you guys being the, you know, being the blue bloods, being the Brahmins, and we've got power now. And we're talking the 1800s, late 1800s, and we're never giving it up, ever. You know, you go to New York. Okay, New York's had a black mayor. New York's got a big enough black population where you can sort of share the city a little bit. You know, Chicago, you've had two black mayors, big enough black population where you can share the road a little bit. Boston is like, Shamrock, this is ours. This is ours. And you got to undo that. And one of the hardest things is that, once again, in terms of fighting with each other, once that real estate starts to build the way it builds, now people are getting pushed out of their neighborhoods. Like, oh, wait a minute. The white people are getting pushed out of their neighborhoods too. So the whole city begins to shift. But historically, that city is a very, very, very insular place. When we were growing up there, they used to tell us all the time, Boston will give you a chance if you start somewhere else. If you start your career somewhere else, then Boston will claim you. They're like, oh, he's from Boston, and we'll bring you home. But you're not starting your career there. There's no entry level for black Bostonians there. And my career started out just like that. I started my career in California. Why? Because there was no real opportunity. I mean, when you go there, and they're trying to change it, the whole thing, but that's the reason. You walk in there and you don't feel like there's a place for you here. That city belongs to them. And you can feel it when you're there. And there's no getting around that. And also, Boston's got a fit, you know, Boston for all the sports part, you know, look, Boston put two racists out there to be the face of their sports media. That's what they did for years. You got to wear that. Too bad. Right? EEI was a flagship station for the Red Sox. Did the Red Sox go, yeah, we don't want to be represented like this? Nope. They took the ratings. So take it and wear it. It's on you.
The one thing I say for Boston, the NBA stuff in particular, I have a talking point for you guys, all you folks in Boston. I think I've told you this one, but if you need to feel like, yo, when you do the what about them thing, this is the one. So, legendarily, Boston has had more white dudes on the team. Like, it was, but you said Boston, Phoenix, and Utah, right? But you could tell, like, with Boston, now, granted, they was typically getting good white dudes. They wasn't just like, give me a white dude, right? Like, they were getting white dudes that could ball, but Red Auerbach seemed to understand that, hey, when we were winning championships, we had all these black dudes, we wasn't selling tickets. So we're going to need to have some white dudes on the bench. Brian Scalabrine never going to have to pay for another meal in Boston for the rest of his life, and he ain't do nothing on the basketball court. He was just the white dude on the Boston Celtics when they won their last championship. He's on the broadcast now. Mm-hmm. Right. So he's going to have all that stuff. Okay, got it. But they always had the white dudes. But they still had a team. Like St. Louis. I forget what documentary I was watching, but people know the story about the St. Louis Spirits, the ABA team, and they had a share of the TV money. When the leagues merged, they took four teams, the Spurs, the Nuggets, the Nets, and the Pacers, and they did not take the Spirits. Now, the thing with the Spirits was the owners were sure that they would get brought into the league because at the time, St. Louis was the largest market that did not have an NBA team. So they were positive they would be absorbed. And the NBA was like, son, we tried this before, and it's just too racist. We can't make it happen. There is your what about if you're Boston. At least we can have a damn basketball team. I tell people, be careful. Watch out. Them places that got hockey teams and no basketball team anywhere nearby, watch what you do at night, baby. You never know how that might go.
Right? Although, and here's what's really interesting, like, from the historical Spirit of St. Louis. And by the way, might be the greatest business deal in the history of sports.
Oh, yes. Sheer dumb luck, but the greatest.
We'll take 0.5% of all your revenues in perpetuity. That's free billions. Anyway, where was Bill Russell going to go if he wasn't traded?
St. Louis.
So Bill Russell had St. Louis or Boston.
Right. He was like, well, that's right, because the Warriors were still on the East Coast, so he could not be a territorial pick for the local market.
Couldn't even go home. That's right.
St. Louis.
Your choices are St. Louis or Boston.
That's
yeah, but it's true. But you know what? I always look at it this way. I'm like, if you want to win, how do you win? It's very, very clear that the Boston Celtics, as a city, as a franchise, and as a city, you're not going to be major players in the free agent market. You got to build your team differently. It's like Toronto. When Toronto in baseball, they always knew that because of the exchange rate and everything else, they had to try to build their team differently. Certain players simply were not going to go to Toronto. They didn't want to pay the taxes. They didn't want to deal with the international element of being on that team. And everybody loves Toronto. Nobody says Toronto, awful city. Toronto is one of the best cities in North America. But still, that didn't mean that people would sign free agent contracts there. Right. So which is why, you know, Masai made that deal. That's the same Anthony Davis thing. I'm not coming there. Yeah, you are. You're coming here anyway. And let's see what we do with it. And mission accomplished. They got their championship. So you're right. I think the defensiveness level is so silly because what you have to look at instead is how do we get players? Not what about Chicago? How do we get players? How do we make this work?
Yeah, good luck. They did a decent job with the drafting. Now they got to keep them. And now who knows who's going to be the coach, the general manager, or anything else.
And let's face it, last thing on Danny, then we can talk about Naomi Osaka, whatever else you want to talk about. But last thing about Danny reminds me of that Saturday Night Live skit back in the day. I don't even know if anybody remembers it. I think it might have been Tom Hanks, where he had the Super Bowl tickets and had a price that he was going to sell them for and no other price. And ended up like holding on and the game was over. And that was Danny with all those draft picks. It's like, dude, you're right. You cannot play for the future. Like, you know, hoarding assets, Danny Ainge, asset hoarder, right? And at the end of the day, did you really maximize what you had there? Now you could make the argument. You really could make the argument. You got Kyrie Irving, you got Jason Tatum, and you got Jaylen Brown. You could say mission accomplished from an acquisition standpoint. You could make that argument. It just didn't work.
Now, for the next part of a Howard Bryant week, Naomi Osaka will not be competing in the French Open. I've seen that you have been trying to talk to people about this on Twitter, and I don't know why.
Unsuccessfully.
Yeah, like I don't really understand why you decided to take on that move. A friend of mine hit me up, and like, here comes Howard talking about what about the journalists? I was like, I actually think it takes a little more nuance than that.
I didn't say what about the journalists, did I?
I mean, but I think that it's difficult for a lot of people who observe media people talking about this, that they view it through the lens of anything other than the media's self-interest.
Well, people hate us. That's the thing that people don't understand about this. It's like, and this story is such an amazing story because, like all amazing stories, it's not a this or that. There are so many other elements to this. When you really want to break this down, though, I mean, the real part of the story is between Naomi Osaka and the federations. It's really, media is sort of third in this. It's them forcing you to do media. And I have always said, when I talk about open locker room and everything else, I walk up to dudes, are you talking today? Nope. Okay, cool. I don't take it personally. You don't have to talk. I cover an industry. The people who run the industry, I expect them to talk. I expect the owners and general managers and those guys to talk. But the athletes, I don't get mad if they don't want to do interviews. It's fine. What I don't like is for them to not want to do interviews and then be criticized for not doing interviews and get mad about that. You don't get to have everything, right? I mean, you do something very, very public. We do critique that. That's what we do, period. That's what the job is. But yeah, I think you realize, look, we're the enemy. And you want to talk about low-hanging fruit. It's very easy to hate media, and especially because media is not even media, right? There's a difference between, you know, Stephen A. and Skip and Max and those guys. They're not in the locker room anymore. You know, that's media, but that's not press. That's not what they're totally different. You know, each element of this is different. And so there's just so many different layers to deal with. And, you know, you always know going in that if you talk about your profession, everybody hates you. And that's fine. We're supposed to have an adversarial relationship at some level with the business, because who wants to be asked questions that they don't want to answer? Who wants to? I mean, I wouldn't want someone calling me, asking me to critique every, you know, I got a problem with your column. Well, good, right? After a while, it's like, get away from me. I mean, what we do is adversarial by nature in a lot of ways. I get that part. But what I don't understand in this story, well, because people are stupid, but, you know, one of the parts that bothers me is if you really break down what's taking place, it's between Naomi Osaka and the Grand Slams. It's not us and Naomi Osaka. I mean, we don't necessarily, you know, make those interview rooms easy. I mean, that all that stuff is very difficult. And, the reporters ask, that's a different layer to this. But the actual point, the battle point here is between the Grand Slams and the athlete, which makes it a labor story.
The problem that I have with a lot of the way that it wound up being received is Osaka herself was very clear on what her problems were with this at various points. Very little of this other discussion has had anything to do with what she said her problem was, right? So coming out the gate, she said that her problem was that, you know, in this time, she gets questions that make her doubt herself and that she does not want to doubt herself in this time. And I think she used the term mental health in that description. And I thought that led to a fair, broader discussion about, I think you're entitled to a certain measure of peace. Are you entitled to confidence, right? Because part of what sports is pushing through those moments of struggling with confidence and so forth and so on, you know? So like, when it was on that one, I was like, I mean, I understand why you don't want to do this, but I don't know if this is the way to go about it. Then came the statement from the Slams, and I got where they were coming from. They're like, we are the show. People are coming here to see us. And it was interesting that it was all the Slams that said that, because the French could say that individually and have an argument. Naomi Osaka was probably not going to still be in the French Open by next week, right? Her track record indicates that probably would not have been it. She was not driving things at the French Open. She's a big star, but she wasn't pushing that engine. No, they would be just fine if she did not do this. But all of them got together because it's like they looked around and they saw what was going on with the world. And they were like, oh, no, no, no. We have to protect the turf. We're all going to get together. And now we're going to do this, which is why it's funny that after Osaka was much more thorough in her explanation about where she's coming from and how she feels while doing this press availability and why it is that she does not want to do it. At that point, our opinions about the larger press conference thing or whatever kind of sort of stopped mattering, right? Like she's talking about something very particular and very
specific.
Yeah, very specific to her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite know how this turned into everything else.
Easy target.
Yeah, but I don't think it's just because they hate us.
Well, it's not just because they hate us. I think one of the theories on this too is that we reflect. People bring their grievances to an issue, even if the issue isn't about their grievances.
There it is.
And the grievance right now is, how are Black women being treated? Every avenue that you have to get us to that point will get you to that point. right? Whatever the subject is, she's not talking about this, but this is an avenue to get to that point.
Yes.
Right? So that's really what we're talking about. People have been laying in wait, waiting. If you cover tennis, if you watch tennis, especially the way tennis is sold because of these, you know, snippets of the press conference, it's like these Black women athletes walk into the podium and get savaged by these, you know, almost completely white international media who ask horrible questions, right? This is the way the tennis fan views tennis, right? What this really does come down to, once again, is massive, massive, massive protection and retribution in some ways. And I don't think retribution is the right word. It's a reassessment of how essentially Venus and Serena have been treated. And now you're going to do it to the heir apparent.
Right. Right. But it isn't what Osaka said.
But it's not what she said. But it's not what she's talking about.
Right, right. It's not what she said the problem was. Right. And so that became the thing. It was a like this broader thing about press conferences. And I honestly mean no disrespect to the people who are listening here, but like y'all don't do this. I do it enough to know the purpose of the press conference or whatever it is, right? But people have some very interesting opinions about press conferences without like even doing any thought as to why it is they exist or what the utility is of crowdsourcing a lot of this stuff. I don't understand why they got to sit there and answer the same question over and over again. Well, actually, the press conference is to stop you from having to answer the same question over and over again, because without the press conference, there's going to be a line of people to ask you the same question over and over again.
Press conferences are a compromise. It's what keeps the locker room closed. Would you rather have open locker room? The answer is like, no, absolutely not. We would rather come out and do press than have that locker room be open.
Yeah, but I also think that if you're putting together a television package about what happened in the match, chances are you're going to take a quote from the press conference, right? That clip that you're going to take and put in and use the sound on tape in your package on the match, that clip is not going to be interesting at all because the television package is not conducive to taking what might be interesting. So like take Bill Belichick, for example, take it to a different sport. We get the on to Cincinnati, on to Cincinnati, on to Cincinnati type stuff. But if you hit Belichick with a good question about football, he will go on and on and on about theory and everything else. And you will find it on Twitter in a block of text that somebody has taken out of the transcript and then shared with everybody else. That is not going to wind up being on television. Another problem with the press conference is that if you are writing your own piece, you don't want this good stuff to be offered at the community trough where everybody now all of a sudden is using your fantastic question or everything else. But as much as everybody says these press conferences are useless, if I tell you there's a press conference on right now, either ESPN will break into it if it's important, or you will go out of your way to watch it. They're not without a measure of utility. There are going to be people there who ask bad questions, certainly, right? It's also hard to ask good questions at a press conference. Like, I don't think people quite understand the degree of difficulty, even for the journalist. Like, I'm on TV too right now. I'm in front of the same room full of people asking this question in the way that you are.
Absolutely. And also, I was never good in press conferences, and for two major reasons. One, I didn't want everybody to know what my questions were. And because it's theater, you get worse questions and you get worse answers. The best interviews you can do are when the cameras are off, because the defensiveness, you know, we live in a time where everybody feels that the goal of interpersonal communications is to dunk on each other. Right. So if you're a professional athlete and somebody's asking you a question on camera, a lot of times they're thinking, well, this question is meant to embarrass me.
Right.
What you're doing is you're trying to create some sort of viral soundbite or viral video that's going to embarrass me, when really what you just want is information. Or maybe you are trying to embarrass them. I don't know. But I know that these press conferences certainly make, you know, when we used to go back into manager's office, it used to work very simply. We'd go into the manager's office covering baseball. TV would come in. The cameras would be on. They would ask their questions. The writers would generally not ask their questions. Then the cameras would go off. And once the cameras went off, then we actually talked to the manager. Then we could actually, we all spoke. We talked about what was on the record. We talked about what was off the record. And we actually had communication. But now when you put everything in podium, in a podium situation, now everything is televised. Everything is advertised in this way. And it creates the possibility or the perception that I'm trying to hurt you, right? I'm trying to embarrass you. I'm trying to get you to say something stupid so the whole world can see it. When really, if you're just sitting at somebody's locker, it's just two people talking, right? I mean, so now that everything has become podium-based and you don't have that at-locker interpersonal stuff anymore, it all looks like theater. It looks like, you know, swordplay. It looks like we're fencing. And that's really, you know, it just adds to the adversarial nature of the job.
Right. And then we get back to Osaka, who's just like, to me, when it sounded like, I don't like doing this. Yeah, I wasn't sure. When it got to, no, like, this is a problem. Oh, okay. I'm with you now.
I was going to say, Bo, that's a really big deal. Because one of the other things that she said was, she said that this is difficult for her, right?
Right.
She said this is difficult for her. She didn't say that it was unfair or unjust or whatever. She didn't say that doing these things is something that she shouldn't have to do. She said, this is difficult for me, right? And yet that has been extrapolated out to, well, we're just killing the athletes and this has to stop and, you know, we're destroying them. And it's like, that's not what's happening. What she's saying is that this piece of this job description, I have trouble with. Now, here's the other piece of this that people don't seem to get, right? Tennis as a sport, the culture, what do you want your sport to look like, is a really big piece of this. And when you cover tennis and when you come up in the game, everything is about mental toughness and sports in general. What do we always talk about? Overcoming adversity, mental toughness, 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 right? And in tennis, you don't have any coaching. You can't talk to anybody on the court. You don't have any teammates. The entire root of the sport, part of being a champion in that sport, is you figuring it out, right? That is really a huge part of this sport. It's, you know, there are no timeouts. It's not like, okay, I serve two double faults and I get to just take a little mental health break and call a timeout. You know, there's a 10-0 run, Celtics call timeout, right? You can't do that in tennis. You got to figure it out. And so some of this, when you start looking at the reaction to it, it's like, oh, well, you know, this is just part of the job. And what's really happening here is you have a player who is suggesting maybe this culture needs to change. Maybe the way we do things in this industry has to change. And part of that is how each individual handles their responsibilities match and post-match. Now, to your question, great question about, are you entitled to confidence? You know, if you're the Williams sisters or someone, you know, part of them, like you heard what both Venus and Serena were saying, you know, I'm thick, I'm not thin, or this is just how I handle it. What they're saying is that my mental toughness in being a champion carries over into these press conferences. Everything I do in terms of my victory comes in the face of all of this hostility around me. Very, very different conversations about what the culture of this sport is going
to
be.
Yeah, and I admit, I don't struggle to empathize with people who struggle with confidence. I just can't relate. Like, there are places where my confidence is shaky, but you just got to do it. And I recognize that that is a bit of a regressive view in the eyes of a lot of people. I don't blame people for seeing it as such. But like, I never know myself personally what the line is. And so, for example, when she says, you know, I don't want to hear these questions that make me doubt myself, my empathy meter on that is on the floor. Like, me personally, I could be wrong about it or whatever. I'm just kind of like, okay, well, I guess that means you got to start doing a lot more winning.
You are in hostile territory. That's how I view damn near everything. It's the difference between, you know, the internal versus the external, right? I believe that the external is hostile territory and that it will always be hostile territory. And I don't expect anybody to be anything but hostile to me when I'm trying to work on something, right? Because everyone's trying to dunk on each other. So I wouldn't expect anything but some level of doubt to be part of it. You listen to Nadal talks about doubt all the time. It's something that, you know, he's actually really fantastic on this subject. I think there's a possibility that I'm going to lose all the time. This is his sort of internal battle of how he deals with his preparation. You can always lose. And so the question to me is also, you know, I think what Osaka was doing in terms of bringing part of this up is, you know, there's a cultural question about how much does the tournament have to bend to help you be a champion? Right? Does it have a responsibility to help you be a champion? Or is this also part of what champions overcome? You overcome the fans, you overcome the media, you overcome yourself, you overcome your opponent. And at the end, you hold up the trophy.
Yeah. it to me is a fascinating story. If we could just stop talking about ourselves, just like even me right there, like I had to recognize I have to step outside of me and the way that I view crises of confidence and recognize this is a different thing for.
Yeah, and I was going to say people. One last thing about that too, is that the reason why this became a journalism or has become a journalism issue is because people have grievance toward media. People have anger toward media. People are upset about how this piece of it works. And also because they don't understand what our jobs are. I think that people have a lack of professional respect for what we do anyway. We're not part of the story. We're not supposed to be part of the story. I got criticized on this because I, you know, sent out a, you know, my own Twitter thread about tactics. I felt like, look, the minute that this thing went public, and this is a generational thing that has to be discussed at some level, that I think that last week, Naomi Osaka's initial statement was one of defiance. At least that's the way that the Grand Slam board saw it. They saw it as defiant. And if you're going to ignore this piece of it, then I just got to laugh. They got their backs up. And once they got their backs up, now it's a fight. And once it's a fight, now we're going to fight. And the Grand Slams decided that, okay, you want to act like this? Okay, here's what we do. I think all of this didn't have to happen. I think that Osaka played two clay tournaments before the French started. She played Madrid and she played Rome. If she had gone behind closed doors and said, hey, is there some way we can work with this? I'm struggling or I'm not dealing with this well. I think the conversation is different. You know, maybe they would still say shut up and play. And even if they did say shut up and play, she could have said, look, I told y'all. This was hard for me. I told you I was struggling. I told you there was difficulty here. I gave you advance warning that something that I'm trying to navigate my way to be a champion here. And y'all didn't listen. Even that makes the conversation different, right? But that part didn't happen. And so now you're in a battle. And, you know, once it becomes a staring contest, then all bets are off.
All right. That is Howard Bryant. Check him out at Meadowlark Media, my man. Greatly appreciated. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing three times a week. My man Gabe Bassein handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. If you only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.